You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Manifestations of Karma. This is Lecture 11, the last lecture in this cycle, entitled Individual Karma and Shared Karma, given in Hamburg on the 28th of May, 1910. A great deal more could be said about the various ways in which karma manifests. However, as this is our last lecture, and the time available was bound to be too short for such a wide topic, you will forgive me for not being able to go into greater detail on this occasion, or answer any of the questions you may have. But our movement will continue to exist, and there will be other opportunities to expand on what we have dealt with in this course of lectures. It will have come before your minds again and again that the human being experiences karma as something definite, which is working at every moment in his life. At every moment of our life, we can look back on what we lived through, what we did, thought, and felt in the incarnations preceding our present one. And we will always find that our present destiny, in inner and outer terms, represents a kind of life account, with all our wise and well-reasoned deeds on the one side, and everything incomprehensible, bad, and ugly on the other side. The surplus, which appears on either side at any one time in life, signifies the destiny of that moment. This raises a number of questions. Let us deal with the most obvious one. What is the connection between what people accomplish together as a community to what we call the individual karma of a particular person? We have already looked at this question from other points of view. When we look back on some event in history, for instance the Persian Wars, you could not possibly assume that this event, looked at from the Greek point of view in the first place, represents something which is solely for the account of the quote, book of destiny, close quote, of those individuals who were involved on the outer physical plane. Think of all the leaders in the Persian Wars, of all the people who sacrificed themselves at that time. Think of everything that was done by these people, from the leaders down to the individual men in the Greek legions. Would you ever, if you contemplated an event such as this in a reasonable frame of mind, simply ascribe the deeds of individuals at that time to their personal karmic accounts? You could not possibly do that. For you could not possibly assume that events that pertain to an entire nation or a major part of civilization mean no more than the sum total of all the individual human beings living out their respective karma. When you look at the course of historical evolution, it is important to proceed from event to event. Then you will find that there is sense and meaning in human evolution itself, and that such events amount to more than individual people's personal karma. We can contemplate an event such as the Persian Wars and ask ourselves what it signifies in humanity's evolution. In the East, a certain civilization had developed which was brilliant and full of light in many ways. But there is no light without shadow. We need to be clear about the fact that the entire culture of the East could only be developed by mankind at the cost of certain darker elements entering into that culture, elements which ought not to have been perpetuated in human development. A prominent element of this nature was the tendency of the East to continue expanding by means of physical force. Of course, without this drive for expansion, the whole of the Eastern civilization would not have come about. One is unthinkable without the other. However, in order that mankind might develop further, the Greek culture, for example, had to develop against a very different background. But the Greek civilization could not have initiated this purely from what it represented itself. It needed certain elements from other places, and it did indeed borrow important elements from the Eastern civilization. various legends about heroic figures who passed from Greece over to the East clearly tell us that the pupils of certain Greek schools had gone over to the East to bring back to the Greeks those treasures of Eastern culture which could only have originated in the Eastern civilization, but were then nurtured and transformed by the specific character of the Greek people, by what the Greeks themselves had developed. To accomplish that, these treasures had to be purged of their darker element. The urge to press forward to the West purely by means of physical force. The Roman civilization, which followed the Greek, and everything else that contributed to the further development of the European peoples, would not have come about if the Greeks had not cleared the way for the further development of Eastern culture and beaten back the Persians and what was associated with them. In this way, beating back the Asians was a means of purifying what had been created in Asia. This is the way to consider all sorts of events in world history, and if you proceed in this way, you will obtain a striking picture. If, in a cycle of lectures over 3 or 4 years, we applied this way of thinking only to what we know about mankind's evolution from historical documents, we would arrive at something we could veritably call a plan in mankind's evolution. We would then look at this plan and say, quote, well, this had to be accomplished. It had its dark sides, and these had to be overcome. What had been accomplished had to be transformed and carried further. Close quote. In this way, we would arrive at a plan of mankind's evolution. And in discussing this plan, it would simply not occur to us to say, quote, how did it come about that Xerxes or Miltiades or Leonidas had this or that personal karma? Close quote. We have to envisage the personal karma of the individual as something that is interwoven with the overall plan of mankind's evolution. There is no other way of grasping the matter. And this is how we go about it in the field of spiritual science. Consequently, we need to recognize that all the events making up the plan of humanity's evolution must be considered to be interconnected in a similar way to karmic events in individual human lives. Then the question may arise as to how this overall plan of mankind's evolution is connected with the personal karma of individual people. Let us first consider what might be termed the destiny of human development as such. When we look back, we see how one civilization after another arises, how the development of one people follows that of another. We see further how people upon people acquire one thing or another which is new, how something permanent is retained from all the individual national cultures, but how, at the same time, whole peoples need to die out in order that their heritage, their individual achievements, may be saved for the corresponding later epochs of human evolution. Then we will understand without difficulty why spiritual science distinguishes between two separate currents in this continuous course of mankind's evolution. Consider what we might look upon as a progressive current in the entire course of humanity's evolution as a succession of waves, but with each wave carrying forward some of its substance to the succeeding one. We can get an idea of this if we consider the first post-Atlantean civilization, the supreme achievements of ancient India. However, when we compare this magnificence with the faint echo of it which is contained in the old Vedas, which in all their greatness offer just a faint reflection of the Rishis' deeds and of what spiritual science tells us about the great culture of the Indians, we are bound to say, quote, the original greatness of what this people accomplished for mankind was already in decline when people set about preserving this treasure of human culture in those magnificent verses. Close quote. However, the initial achievements of Indian civilization, flowed into the entire course of mankind's evolution. And this alone made it possible for that to develop later on, for which a younger substance was needed, in contrast to that of a people grown old. First of all, the Indians had to be pushed back to the southern peninsula. Then the Zarathustrian worldview developed in Persia. Think of the greatness of this worldview at the time it originated, and how relatively quickly it declined among the very people who created it. We see the same thing happen in Egypt and Chaldea. Then we see the wisdom of the East pass over to Greece, and we see the Greeks beat back what is Eastern on the outer physical plane. In the wake of that, the cultural achievements of the entire Orient are taken up into the lap of Greece, and interwoven with much that had been acquired in other regions of Europe. Out of this, a new element of culture was created, which made it possible by a very circuitous route to take up the Christian impulse and transplant it into the West. And in this way, we would also find a continuous current of civilization following on into later periods, which consists of different successive elements, each representing a continuation of the preceding one, and at the same time something new that had to be bestowed upon mankind. But where did that which thus develops further from epoch to epoch actually originate? Think of everything each nation experiences in its own culture. Think of everything that must come to pass in each people as a totality of countless individuals' feelings and sensations, of wishes and enthusiasm for what must be deemed the ultimate achievement, and what constituted the characteristic element of the culture concerned. Think of how the souls of the people had to be totally united with what they desired and aspired to in the context of a particular culture. And in addition, it was necessary, over innumerable centuries of mankind's evolution, that the various peoples, in developing the various cultures which succeeded one another, always lived with a kind of illusion. The illusion that every such people regarded the particular achievement of its own civilization as something eternal and imperishable, which could never be taken from it. It is only the emergence of this illusion over and over again which made possible the devotion of individual peoples to building a civilization in the belief that what was being created would last forever. This illusion exists today, too. It is true we are no longer giving ourselves over to it with quite such abandon, and we do not speak of the everlasting nature of this or that culture. But it nevertheless exists in the form of our not thinking things through to the end, neither in small matters nor in more significant ones, in our not paying any attention to it, as it were. There you have two things that were needed by the various peoples to develop their particular cultures. And it is only in our time that things are beginning to change somewhat. For the first realm of cultural life in which such illusions will no longer appear will be that founded on anthroposophy. It would be a gross misunderstanding of someone who stands on the firm ground of our cultural spiritual movement or to believe that the forms in which we choose to express what we know, the thoughts we are able to develop at this point, that which we are able to give today out of our anthroposophical thinking, feeling, and willing should be everlasting. It would be extremely short-sighted to maintain that people will discuss anthroposophical truths in 3,000 years' time, as we do today. We know that on account of the conditions of our time, we have to cast some of the continuous product of evolution into the forms prevalent today, and that our successors will express and experience these things very differently. Why is this so? The reason for this is similar to that which caused individual people in many different cultures throughout the centuries and millennia to go through experiences which contributed to the overall development of the culture concerned. Think of the countless experiences people went through in ancient Greece, and think of what issued from that later as an extract for the whole of mankind. Then you will say, quote, "There is a lot more to this than just the individual currents concerned. Many things happen for the sake of the one primary current." Close quote. So we must observe two things. First, something that must spring up and die away, in order that from this whole, a second thing, in quantitative terms, the smallest constituent, may survive as something lasting. Only when we realize that two powers, Lucifer and Ahriman, have been active in human evolution ever since personal individual karma has existed, shall we be able to understand the progress of human evolution. For the aim of this plan of human evolution is that finally, when the earth will have attained its goal, those experiences which were gradually embodied into the whole of humanity's evolution, out of the different cultures, will bear fruit for all the different individuals, no matter what personal destinies they may have gone through. But to see this goal, we have to look at the world's evolution in the light of anthroposophy. For we must not deceive ourselves. This goal must be conceived of in the right way, always keeping in mind the intactness and everlasting nature of the human individuality, which continues to absorb what humanity as a whole has acquired, has, as opposed to merging into some kind of nebulous pantheistic unity. And this goal can only be apprehended by the life of soul imbued with anthroposophy. Therefore, if we look back on earlier civilizations, we can say, quote, "Ever since human individualities have incarnated, Lucifer and Ahriman have participated in human evolution." Close quote. Lucifer seeks to participate in the progressive stream of civilization by entering into human beings' astral bodies, impregnating them with the Luciferic impulse. This is Lucifer's activity in the course of mankind's evolution. He works into the human astral bodies. Human beings could never acquire what they are given by Lucifer just from the powers which drive on the progressive stream of cultural evolution, which I have just described to you. If you look at this progressive stream in isolation from the overall course of human development, you can see what the normally progressing spirit beings of the hierarchies bestow upon humanity as ever-renewing gifts. Looking up to the hierarchies, we cannot but say, quote, "The spiritual beings who are developing normally have given the earth what has become mankind's lasting possession. It has been transformed in the course of time, it is true, but it has become our lasting possession. It is like a tree and the pith within it. This is the continuous living stream of progressive civilization." Close quote. The powers that are developing normally could have brought it about that man endowed his eye evermore with this progressive enrichment of human evolution. Then only that which brings us further would have flowed in from time to time. We would be filled more and more with the gifts of the spiritual world. And finally, when the earth had reached its goal, it stands to reason that we would be imbued with everything given to us by the spiritual worlds. However, one thing would not be possible. We should not have been able to develop that original and ardent power of striving, that devotion and fiery enthusiasm for all that is created in one age of civilization after another. The same grounds which bring forth every single aspiration, every desire, equally bring forth the aspiration for the great ideals of humanity, the desire to ennoble and beautify human existence, to create art in the successive periods of human civilization. The same grounds which bring forth injurious desires leading to evil also bring forth the striving after the highest that can be accomplished upon earth. And this capacity of the human soul to be enkindled for the highest ideals would not exist if it was not possible, on the other hand, for this same ardent desire to sink into vice and evil. That this is possible in the evolution of mankind is the work of the Luciferic spirits. We must not fail to recognize that together with the possibility of evil, the Luciferic spirits have brought us freedom, so that we may freely receive what would otherwise simply flow into our souls. However, we have also found that everything which Lucifer brings about challenges a response by Ahriman. Thus we see Lucifer and all his hosts work in that specific element of the Greek culture that was to be given to humanity as a whole, in the great heroes and artists of Greece. We see Lucifer penetrating into their astral bodies, causing them to be inflamed with passion for what they honor as the highest. Thus, the element which is to flow into human evolution through the Greeks becomes the enthusiasm of the entire folk soul, and that is exactly where Lucifer is lodged. And as Lucifer owes his power to the moon, as opposed to the earth evolution, he challenges Ahriman to come forth. And as Lucifer develops his activity in the successive periods, Ahriman joins in and destroys bit by bit what Lucifer has brought about on earth. The cosmic evolution of man is a continuous interplay between Ahriman and Lucifer. Without Lucifer's work in human development, there would be no passion, no enthusiasm for the progressive stream of human evolution. Without Ahriman, who destroys in culture after culture whatever arose from Lucifer's influence, and is not part of the progressive stream, Lucifer would simply perpetuate individual cultures ad infinitum. Here you see Lucifer fulfilling his own karma, which is an inevitable consequence of his development on the ancient moon. And from this it follows that Ahriman must always be chained to Lucifer's heels. Ahriman is Lucifer's karmic fulfillment. This has given us an insight into the karma of higher beings, by the example of the Ahrimanic and Luciferic ones. There, too, karma holds sway. Wherever there are I individualities, there is karma. Of course, Lucifer and Ahriman, too, are bearers of capital I's, and that is why the effects of their deeds can react upon them. Many of these mysteries will be dealt with in the summer during the lecture cycle on the biblical story of creation. There is just one thing I would like to point out now, because it will show you very clearly how infinitely profound each single word really is in the true occult records. Have you ever wondered why it is that in the Bible's history of the creation, there is this sentence at the end of each day of creation, quote, "And the Elohim saw the work, and they saw that it was very good, that it was of the best," close quote. These are significant words. Why are they there? After all, the sentence itself shows that it is intended to characterize the Elohim, which developed on the moon in the normal manner, and whose opponent is Lucifer. It is something characteristic of the Elohim that they saw after each day of creation that it was, quote, "of the best," close quote. It was given for the reason that this was the Elohim's degree of attainment. Upon the moon, they could only see their work as long as they were performing it. They could have no subsequent consciousness of it. That they were able subsequently to look back reflectively upon their work marks a particular stage in the Elohim's consciousness. This only became possible upon the earth. Indeed, their inner nature is revealed by the fact that the element of will thus issues forth from their being. When they looked at the work, they saw that it was very good. These were the Elohim, who had completed their work upon the moon, and who, when they looked at it afterward upon the earth, were able to say, quote, "It can remain. It is very good." Close quote. But for that, it was necessary that their development upon the old moon should be completed. Now, what about the Luciferic beings? In other words, those beings whose development on the moon was not completed. They will equally have to try and look upon their work on the earth, for example, their contribution to the ardor and enthusiasm of the Greek civilization. Then they will see how Ahriman has caused it to crumble away, bit by bit. And they will have to say, because they have not completed it, quote, "They beheld their day's work, and they saw that it was not of the best, that it had to be blotted out." Close quote. That is the great disappointment of the Luciferic spirits. They are continually trying to do their work over again, forever trying to swing the pendulum to the other side, only to find their work destroyed by Ahriman again and again. You must think of it as an ebb and flow in the tide of human evolution, a continuous rousing of new forces by beings higher than ourselves, and the experiencing by them of continual disappointments. This is part of the experience of the Luciferic spirits in the earth's evolution. And humanity had to take on this karma because it is the only way we could attain real freedom. Freedom is only possible when we ourselves attain to the highest development of our earthly I. If we reached all our goals at the end of Earth's development because they were given to us, our I could not be free. For from the beginning it was predestined that all the good of the Earth's evolution should flow into man. Man could only become free by adding to this I another, which is capable of error, and is able to swing backwards and forwards between good and evil, and strive again and again after that which is the purpose of all earthly evolution. The lower I had to be given us by Lucifer, in order that our striving toward the higher I should be our own original deed. This is what gave us the possibility of free will. Free will is something which we may acquire bit by bit in the course of time, for we are placed into this life in such a way that this possibility of free will is a constant ideal before our minds. Is there, after all, a state of balance in our development when our human will is free? It is never free, because it can succumb to the Luciferic and Ahrimanic elements at any moment in time. It is not free because every human being retains a very definite impression on having passed through the portal of death during the ascending part of Kamaloka, and possibly over several decades. The main purpose of our life in Kamaloka is that we should recognize to what degree we ourselves are imperfect as a result of the imperfect deeds we committed in the world, that we should see step by step in which ways we have become imperfect. This then gives rise to our firm resolve to make good what we have rendered imperfect. This is how we live through Kamaloka, adding one intention to another and deciding summarily, quote, "I must make good everything that I thought and did which lowered me," close quote. We imprint what we feel during that time into our further life and enter into existence through birth with the appropriate intention. And this is how we take on our own karma. Hence we cannot say that we have a free will if we have entered existence through birth. At most we can say that we may approach the ideal of a free will to the degree in which we succeed in mastering the influences of Lucifer and Ahriman. And nothing but knowledge will enable us to master the Luciferic and Ahrimanic influences. Firstly, self-knowledge, which means that we become increasingly able to recognize, also in our life between birth and death, our weaknesses in all our three soul faculties of thinking, feeling, and will. After all, the harder we strive not to succumb to illusion, the greater will be the strength of our I to do without Lucifer's influence, and the better we shall be able to decide what degree of devotion the treasures of mankind that have been attained over time really deserve. Secondly, we need knowledge of the outer world to complement our self-knowledge. The two must work together. Self-knowledge and knowledge of the outer world must become part of our being. Then we shall be able to be clear about our relationship to Lucifer. We study anthroposophy in order to gain a clearer idea to what extent all our actions, our inclinations, and our passions involve the activity of Lucifer and Ahriman. This is the special feature of our endeavor. What have we done in this series of lectures other than enlighten ourselves about the manifold ways in which luciferic and Ahrimanic forces play into our lives? In our time, it is appropriate to start enlightening people about the luciferic and Ahrimanic forces. Human beings need to be enlightened if they really are to contribute something to the goal of humanity's earth existence. Wherever you look, wherever human beings are feeling and thinking, you can see how far removed humanity still is from being really and truly enlightened about the effects of Lucifer and Ahriman. You will find that the majority of people do not want any such enlightenment at all. You will find a great many people succumb to a certain kind of religious egotism. All they want is the greatest imaginable state of well-being for their own soul. People are not aware that all sorts of gross desires can be associated with this kind of egotism. Nowhere does Lucifer play a greater part in our feelings than when we strive to ascend to the divine from out of our passions and desires, without having had the divine illuminated by the light of knowledge. Do you not believe that Lucifer often has an especially great part to play in the very places where people consider themselves to be striving for the highest? But the forms of expression that are striven for in this way will also be numbered among Lucifer's disappointments. And those who believe that they will be able to maintain one form of spiritual culture or another on the basis of crass desires, and who never tire of preaching that this anthroposophy is so bad because it believes in something new, ought to consider that it does not depend on human will that Ahriman fastens himself to the heels of Lucifer. The forms of religious striving which have arisen in the course of time will, because Ahriman mingles into them, go under again through Lucifer. The progressive stream of human evolution alone will be saved. We know that during earlier stages of evolution, certain beings sacrificed themselves and stayed behind for our sake. We have established that these beings need to live out their karma for our sake, so that we may express in a normal way what these beings can bestow on us. Indeed, Jehovah originally gave man the capacity to absorb the capital I through the divine breath. If only that divine breath had entered, which pulsates in our blood. Without that which is capable of straying again and again from the gifts of Jehovah's breath, without the luciferic as well as the Ahrimanic impulses in it, we would have attained to the actual gift of Jehovah, it is true. But without the differentiation of a free I, conscious of self. Thus it is part of the cosmic plan that certain beings remained behind. We live in an age today where we may indeed look back on many disappointments of Lucifer, but at the same time look forward to a culture in which we shall understand with ever greater clarity what the progressive stream of evolution actually is. Anthroposophy will be the instrument for understanding this progressive stream of evolution. so that we may become ever more conscious of Lucifer's influences, ever more capable of recognizing Luciferic influences within ourselves. In this way we shall be better equipped, consciously, to make use of such influences for the good of humanity, instead of allowing them to work as they previously did, as dim impulses of which we are not conscious. The same applies to the Ahrimanic influences. It is appropriate to point out in this connection that we are in the midst of an important stage of humanity's development, namely, that epoch where the soul forces of human beings are actually reversed in a certain respect. Many of you will be aware already that an age is before us in which certain people, certain individuals, will develop soul faculties different from those recognized today. For example, what anthroposophy can state from the results of spiritual scientific research, namely that the human being possesses an etheric body in relation to his physical body, can today only be perceived by people who have undergone an appropriate methodical training. But there will be people before the middle of the 20th century, and this is known from reading the Akashic Record, who will have naturally developed the gift of etheric clairvoyance, and who, since mankind has reached the epoch in which this will develop as a natural gift, will perceive the etheric body as permeating the physical body and extending beyond it. Just as man, once able to see into the spiritual world, has descended to the merely physical perception and intellectual comprehension of the outer world, so he is gradually beginning now to develop new, but this time conscious, capacities, which will be added to the old ones. One of these special new faculties I should like to characterize. There will be people, at first only a few, for only in the course of the next 2,000 or 3,000 years will these faculties evolve in greater numbers, and these first forerunners will be born before the end of the first half of the 20th century, who will experience something like the following. These people will have some experience or other, and then feel inclined to step back somewhat from what they were involved in. Then they will have a picture before them which arises from the action concerned. First of all, they will not recognize it, and will not be able to relate it to what they were involved in. But then, they may have heard something or other of spiritual science, they will discover that this picture, which appeared to them like a kind of conscious dream image, is the counter-image of their own deed. A picture of what needs to be done in order that the deed actually performed may be karmically fulfilled. Thus we are indeed approaching an age in which we will not only understand karma from the teachings of spiritual science, but will actually begin to perceive karma. Whereas, until now, karma was for us an obscure impulse, an unspecified longing which could only be fulfilled in the following life, and which could only be transformed into an intention during the life between death and a new birth, we will gradually evolve toward consciously perceiving Lucifer's creations, toward identifying their effects. However, this power of etheric clairvoyance will only be of use to people who have striven after knowledge and self-knowledge. But even in normal circumstances, people will perceive the karmic pictures of their actions to an ever greater degree. It will be something that will carry human beings further and further in their development, because it will enable them to find out what they still owe to the world, what is left on the debit side of their karma. After all, what makes us unfree is the fact that we do not know what we still owe the world. That is why it is wrong to speak casually of free will in connection with karma. The expression free will in itself is wrong. We should rather say, quote, we as human beings only become free through enhancing our cognitive faculties and through rising higher and growing closer with the spiritual world. In this way, we will be filled more and more with what the spiritual world has to give us, and gradually develop into beings capable of mastering our own will. Close quote. It is not the will that can become free. It is the human being as a whole who can become free through absorbing the knowledge of the spiritual world. Thus we look upon Lucifer's disappointments and his deeds and say, quote, "The foundations for the position we occupy today have been built over thousands of years. If we did not stand where we stand today, we could not evolve to freedom." But we are in a position to enlighten ourselves with regard to Lucifer and Ahriman. No, let me read that again. But as we are in a position to enlighten ourselves with regard to Lucifer and Ahriman, we are able to relate to these powers in a new way and gather the fruit from what has been accomplished. We can, as it were, take over the work of Lucifer and Ahriman. Close quote. However, the deeds of Lucifer, the developments he inspired, which have caused no end of disillusionment, will have to be turned into their opposite if we are to perform them ourselves. Lucifer's deeds were conditional upon creating wishes and desires, upon leading people into the proximity of evil. We have seen what kind of power is needed to oppose Lucifer. If we ourselves are to counteract Lucifer, if we are to manage his affairs in the future, we will only be able to do this with the power of love. Love will be able to take the place of Lucifer's deeds. Indeed, it will. And so will that which comes to us from the world outside, when we succeed in ever greater measure in dispelling the darkness which we ourselves weave into outer matter. If we manage gradually to remove this darkness, when this darkness lifts and we reach the stage where the Ahrimanic influence can be totally overcome, only then will we be in a position to know this earthly world as it really is. Then we will gradually come closer to the kind of knowledge which is today confined to the realms of spiritual science. We shall penetrate to the real essence of matter, to the nature of light. Present-day science is still subject to all sorts of deceptions as to the nature of light. Many believe that we see light with our physical eyes. It is not true. With our physical eyes we do not see light, but merely illuminated bodies. We see these bodies in different colors. We do not see light, but we see through the light. All such deceptions will be swept away. This will transform our view of the world, which had to be riddled with error under Ahriman's influence. It will be permeated with wisdom. Through penetrating to the light, we ourselves will develop the soul's counterpart of light. The soul's counterpart of light is wisdom. This is how love and wisdom will enter the human soul. And love and wisdom will make up the practical strength, the vital impulse that should and eventually will grow from the anthroposophical view of the world. Wisdom, which is the inner counterpart of light, wisdom united with love, and love permeated by wisdom will find the right way to react upon that which is immersed in the wisdom of the outer world. If we are to partake to an ever-increasing degree in the other half of evolution and overcome Lucifer and Ahriman, we must permeate ourselves with wisdom and love. In developing wisdom and love, we shall be developing the very elements which will need to issue from our souls as gifts to those who sacrificed their own development in the first half of the Earth's evolution. The Luciferic and the Ahrimanic powers, who thus gave us what we needed to become free. However, one thing must be clear to us. The world is a living thing, and the culture we develop must express what is living. We shall gladly and lovingly devote ourselves to building a culture of anthroposophy which will not last forever. We shall accept this with unbroken enthusiasm and proceed to create with love what formerly we created driven by Lucifer. Because we recognize now that we have to create out of love what we were formerly driven to create by Lucifer's influence, through passions and desires, we will develop all the more love, a superabundance of love. Without such superabundance of love, we should not be able to develop culture after culture. Anthroposophy should be something which inspires people to do what is needed in their time with devotion and love, with the same enthusiasm that people developed in earlier times under the influence of Lucifer. We shall no longer harbor the illusion that what we are doing will last forever. And in creating culture after culture with love and more love, we shall create a superabundance of love. This will benefit Lucifer. It will also counterbalance his disappointments. It is up to us to compensate Lucifer for the disappointments he had to suffer by repaying what has been given us. This is the other aspect of the karma of higher beings. That we develop a power of love which is not confined to humanity alone, but which penetrates right into the cosmos. We shall be able to channel this love into beings higher than ourselves, and they will accept this as our offering. It will be a soul sacrifice. This sacrifice in soul will rise up to those who once poured their gifts upon us, like the smoke of incense rising up to the spirits in times when human beings still possessed the gifts of the Spirit. In those days they were able to send up the symbolic smoke of sacrifice to the gods. In times to come they will send up streams of love to the spirits, and out of this offering of love higher forces will pour down to humankind, which will work with ever-increasing power in our physical world, directed by the spiritual world. These will be magical forces in the true sense. Thus the evolution of mankind encompasses the fulfillment of human karma and the karma of higher beings. We now can grasp how the overall plan of evolution relates to the personal karma of human beings. Let us assume that a superhuman individuality brought something about in the year 1910, which was carried out on the physical plane by a human being. In this way a contact is established between them, and the person is interwoven with the karma of higher beings. This would establish a definite correlation. But then something different streams down to him from the higher worlds, bringing a new element to his life. This would then establish a new item which is added to his karma, and will make the pendulum swing this way or that. Thus, human karma is fructified by the general karma that streams through the world. Consider Miltiades, for example, or some other personality. There they stood in the great plan of their people's history, and some karma of higher powers was involved, and there they were, placed at their post. What poured into their personal karmic account was to benefit the whole of humanity. And by fulfilling it, by following up with action and deed, they made it their individual karma. Thus we live and weave into the macrocosm with our personal karma as microcosms. We have now reached the end of this course of lectures, although we have by no means exhausted the subject. But this was only to be expected. There are just two things I would like to say to you now. I have given this series of lectures about those very human questions that are so apt to stir our hearts deeply, and are at the same time connected with the great destinies of the highest of beings. I have truly given this course from the depths of my soul, and I am happy that it was possible for once to speak about this in an anthroposophical circle, among friends who have come here from all directions to devote themselves to the study of these questions. I am speaking these words from the depths of my heart. Those who will be able to attend further courses will find that many of the questions that may have arisen in the context of this cycle of lectures will be answered then. But also, those who will not be able to attend the summer courses will have the opportunity later on to talk to me. Allow me to express my wish once more that that which I have conveyed to you should be more to you than merely abstract knowledge, that it should imbue your thinking, your feeling, and your will, your whole life, so that one should be able to see in the anthroposophists who are out in the world something which really represents the profound truth of anthroposophy. Let us endeavor to become true representatives in this way, for only then will the spiritual substance of anthroposophy flow into the world. In the context of our small circles, we need to devote ourselves first and foremost to the study of spiritual knowledge. But then the knowledge thus acquired must shape our fundamental attitudes and determine the way in which we place ourselves into the world. The world will gradually see that it was not in vain that at the turning point of the 20th century there lived honest and upright anthroposophists, people who sincerely believed in the power of the Spirit and whose belief afforded them the strength to work for it. Our life, our culture, will advance in leaps and bounds if you yourselves transform what you have received here into your very attitude to life and put it into practice. Nothing will be achieved by trying to convince people. That is not appropriate in our time. For only those who come to anthroposophy out of their heart's deepest longing will ever be truly convinced. Those who do not will not be convinced. This is the inevitable karma of materialism, and it manifests in a spiritual context too. We have to view these detrimental effects as something against which spiritual science must prove itself as a power of the Spirit. In this way, we must give the world what we are able to give it out of the essence of our whole being. When we will have made anthroposophy into an inner force of soul, we will be spiritual sources of strength. And whosoever will believe in the supersensible may be absolutely convinced that what we know and feel and do out of anthroposophy works spiritually. It will spread invisibly into the world if we truly make ourselves into a conscious instrument of anthroposophical life. That is the end of Lecture 11 and the end of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner, Manifestations of Karma.